From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When you, the German people, tore down that wall, a wall that divided East and West, freedom and tyranny, fear and hope, walls came tumbling down around the world.
Barack Obama in Berlin. The rally of hundreds of thousands was the largest held by any presidential candidate this year. Then Maine Corps, new evidence about the Bush spy program and a top secret database. Salon obtains documents that point to a potential investigation of the White House that could rival Watergate. Then to Chicago, where nearly 10,000 journalists of color are gathering for the Unity Convention. We'll host a roundtable discussion. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. A newly disclosed memo shows Bush administration lawyers told CIA interrogators they could use a series of harsh measures, including waterboarding, so long as they believed they were acting, quote, in good faith. The August 2002 memo was apparently written to address CIA concerns its officers could once face torture charges for carrying out White House-approved techniques. The Bush administration's instructions said officers needed only to believe they weren't deliberately inflicting severe pain to cause harm. The memo says, quote, although an honest belief need not be reasonable, such a belief is easier to establish where there's a reasonable basis for it. It continues, the absence of specific intent negates the charge of torture. The administration ultimately rescinded the directive 3 years later. The memo was released under a Freedom of Information Act request filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. Jamil Jaffer, director of the ACLU National Security Project, said, quote, these documents supply further evidence, if any were needed, that the Justice Department authorized the CIA to torture prisoners in its custody. The Justice Department twisted the law and in some cases ignored it altogether in order to permit interrogators to use barbaric methods that the U.S. once prosecuted as war crimes. On the campaign trail, Democratic candidate Barack Obama continued an overseas trip Thursday with a speech in Germany. Speaking before hundreds of thousands of people, Obama called for increased international cooperation and defended his call for escalating the U.S.-led occupation of Afghanistan.
No one welcomes war. I recognize the enormous difficulties in Afghanistan. But my country and yours have a stake in seeing that NATO's first mission beyond Europe's borders is a success.
Obama was speaking at the Victory Column in Berlin. His talk drew criticism from Republican candidate John McCain.
I would rather speak at a rally or a gathering any place outside of the United States after I am president of the United States. But that's a judgment that Senator Obama and the American people will make.
In Afghanistan, the U.S. military says it's investigating three separate airstrikes that have killed an estimated 78 civilians this month. More than half of the dead were women and children, including 47 killed at a wedding party in the eastern province of Nangarhar. UN figures show killings of civilians are up 40% over the same period last year. According to Human Rights Watch, U.S.-led airstrikes have killed 119 civilians this year. In Israel and the occupied territories, the Israeli government's announced plans to build a new settlement in the occupied West Bank. Critics call the move a new escalation in Israel's repeated violations of U.S.-backed agreements. Israel had previously vowed to stop settlement activity, but then claimed its pledge only applied to building new settlements, not expanding existing ones. The latest plan violates even that claim. 20 homes are slated to be built at the site known as Maskiot, near the West Bank's eastern border with Jordan. In a statement, the State Department refused to condemn the Israeli move, calling it, quote, not helpful. In Argentina, a former army commander has been sentenced to life in prison. Luciano Benjamin Menendez was convicted on charges of kidnapping, torturing, and killing left-wing dissidents during Argentina's seven-year dictatorship beginning in 1976. Activists and relatives of victims celebrated outside the courtroom.
I feel like justice has been served. And in all truth, this war criminal, the repressor known as Luciano Benjamin Menendez, is going to rot in jail, which is exactly what he deserves.
Some 30,000 people are believed to have died under the Argentine dictatorship. The Bush administration's proposing to shift more than $200 million in foreign aid to Pakistan in order to upgrade Lockheed Martin F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. says the jets would help target militants in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Critics fear the move could escalate Pakistani tensions with India. State Department spokesperson Gonzalo Gallegos defended the plan.
You know, the bottom line here is that we've shifted money to help the democratically elected government of Pakistan to fight a common foe, a common enemy that we have. We believe that these upgrades that had already been approved will help the Pakistanis, will help the Pakistanis help us fight this common foe, and that we believe this is a positive way to help a friend.
The International Olympic Committee has banned Iraq's seven-member team from next month's Summer Games in Beijing. Olympic officials say the Iraqi government broke the rules when it disbanded its Olympic Committee earlier this year. Iraq's Hussein Al-Mahmidi criticized the Olympic decision.
We consider this day as a black day in the history of Iraqi sport. It is a black day as it terminates all the aspirations of the Iraqi athletes and their hopes to achieve personal records, Iraqi records and records of their national unions. All these hopes have come to an end. This day because of this decision, which is done not by Iraqi hands, but by foreign hands.
Back in the United States, the House Judiciary Committee is slated to hold a hearing today on Congressmember Dennis Kucinich's measure to impeach President Bush. The single article of impeachment accuses Bush of deceiving Congress to authorize the invasion of Iraq. The witness list includes Kucinich, New York Congressmember Maurice Hinchey, Utah Mayor Rocky Anderson, former Associate Deputy Attorney General Bruce Fein, along with several other constitutional experts and current and former lawmakers. Meanwhile, an online movement for the imprisonment of former White House deputy Karl Rove is gathering steam. Organizers of SendRoveToJail.com say they've collected more than 100,000 signatures backing Rove's jailing for contempt of Congress. Rove has ignored a Judiciary Committee subpoena for his testimony on the prosecution of former Alabama Democratic Governor Don Siegelman. A Republican lawmaker has introduced a measure to ban several Iranian television channels, including the news network Press TV. House Resolution 1308 would label each channel, quote, a specifically designated global terrorist. Co-sponsor Gus Bilirakis says the network's broadcast incitement to violence against the United States. And the South African judge, Navanethem Pillay, has been named the new UN Commissioner for Human Rights. Pillay spent years defending opponents of the apartheid regime. She went on to help establish the UN War Crimes Court in Rwanda before becoming a World Court judge in 2003. Pillay replaces the departing Canadian Supreme Court Justice Louise Arbour. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic presidential candidate Senator Barack Obama is heading to Paris and London today, the latest stops on his week-long tour of the Middle East and Europe. On Thursday, before an audience of over 200,000 people in Berlin, Germany, Obama said the world must tear down walls dividing people.
That is why the greatest danger of all is to allow new walls to divide us from one another. The walls between old allies on either side of the Atlantic cannot stand. The walls between the countries with the most and those with the least cannot stand. The walls between races and tribes, natives and immigrants, Christians and Muslims and Jews cannot stand. These now are the walls we must tear down.
The rally in Berlin was the largest held by any presidential candidate this year. While Obama spoke in Berlin, his Republican rival John McCain campaigned in Ohio. McCain's stops on Thursday included a German sausage restaurant in Columbus, Ohio. A McCain spokesperson accused Obama of taking a premature victory lap in Berlin. The spokesperson, Tucker Bonds, said, quote, John McCain has dedicated his life to serving, improving, and protecting America. Barack Obama spent an afternoon talking about it. Obama's speech in Berlin was short on specific policy goals, but he urged closer U.S.-European ties and for NATO nations, including Germany, to send more troops to fight in Afghanistan. He also discussed the importance of the Berlin Wall being torn down.
History has led us to a new crossroad, with new promise, a new peril when you, the German people, tore down that wall, a wall that divided East and West, freedom and tyranny, fear and hope. Walls came tumbling down around the world. From Kiev to Cape Town, prison camps were closed and the doors of democracy were opened. Markets opened too, and the spread of information and technology reduced barriers to opportunity and prosperity. While the 20th century taught us that we share a common destiny, the 21st century has revealed a world more intertwined than at any time in human history. The fall of the Berlin Wall brought new hope, but that very closeness has given rise to new dangers, dangers that cannot be contained within the borders of a country or by the distance of an ocean. Think about it. The terrorists of September 11th plotted in Hamburg and trained in Kandahar and Karachi before killing thousands from all over the globe on American soil. As we speak, cars in Boston and factories in Beijing are melting the ice caps in the Arctic, shrinking coastlines in the Atlantic, and bringing drought to farms from Kansas to Kenya. Poorly secured nuclear material in the former Soviet Union or secrets from a scientist in Pakistan could help build a bomb that detonates in Paris. The poppies in Afghanistan come to Berlin in the form of heroin. The poverty and violence in Somalia breeds the terror of tomorrow. The genocide in Darfur shames the conscience of us all. In this new world, such dangerous currents have swept along faster than our efforts to contain them. And that is why we cannot afford to be divided. No one nation, no matter how large or powerful, can defeat such challenges alone. None of us can deny these threats or escape responsibility in meeting them. Yet in the absence of Soviet tanks and a terrible wall, it has become easy to forget this truth. And if we're honest with each other, we know that sometimes, on both sides of the Atlantic, we have drifted apart and forgotten our shared destiny.
To talk more about Senator Barack Obama's tour of the Middle East and Europe, I'm joined by Stephen Clemens in Washington. He's the director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, runs the popular blog, thewashingtonnote.com. Your thoughts on, well, this historic presidential candidate address? I don't know if any other has ever gathered that many people outside the United States, not president like John F. Kennedy, but presidential candidate Barack Obama in Berlin. Stephen Clemens.
Well, good morning, Amy. This speech and Barack Obama's tour have been mesmerizing to watch and to see. It's very strange in American politics when you see the need that a candidate feels he has in this case to connect with so many foreign citizens beyond our borders as a way to prove to American citizens that their future in foreign policy and national security issues will be different than what they've seen under President Bush. And I think Barack Obama delivered that on this tour, and he punctuated it with his speech yesterday. It was a terrific oratory, and I think that he should be given enormous applause for it. What I found a little disappointing in his call for a world without walls, however, was that this speech nonetheless was still a safe speech. It was given in a safe place. If he had given this kind of speech in Israel or Palestine and talked about a different sort of walls and a divided society, it would have been even a greater game changer in that environment. So on one hand, I certainly applaud Barack Obama for this speech and what he's been able to achieve. And I think it shows it's a real foil to the kind of world we're living in under the George W. Bush administration. But it also reminds us that the Middle East, which I think is the defining challenge for America in this era, remains quite complicated with walls and settlements and a divided society that is echoing and ricocheting through the Middle East and creating an enormous hemorrhage in the region and for us that his speech might have addressed there rather than in the safe venue of Berlin.
You mean tearing down the walls in the West Bank?
Well, in the West Bank and really, hit the most powerful part of the speech was the part calling for walls between Christians and Muslims and Jews to come down. And to some degree, I think that's what we need to see in a lot of the Middle East. But nonetheless, I had Mustafa Barghouti in Washington yesterday, one of the former presidential aspirants for Palestine and a good guy, a secularist who's trying to move forward an internal issue in Palestine. And he shared with me, he says, Barack Obama was in Ramallah for 45 minutes and in Israel for about 30 hours. And had he given that kind of speech, a lot of Muslims listened to that speech yesterday, they would have loved to have heard any comment of that sort in Israel. And again, I'm not highly critical of Barack Obama. This is an election season and you need to stage a lot of visuals. But his speech was so powerful, so important, that it was sad that echoes of it did not play in Israel.
You also talk, Stephen Clements, in your pieces about, where Barack Obama is going, has gone, and where he's not going in Europe.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things I found interesting is in his really amazing, I think he's checked off a lot of countries, and I think it was great to get him out on the international stage and not to be shy about it. But at the same time, Europe is vital to us as a place. It is becoming, I think, increasingly important in showing other societies around the world what civil liberty creation and civil society creation can look like as Europe expands. But Europe's institutional heart is no longer Berlin or Paris or London. While those are power centers, Brussels is. And so when you're reaching out to 500 million people and trying to show what the promise is tomorrow of what Europe is struggling to become, not to spend a couple of hours and check off that Brussels box, I think was a big mistake.
We're talking to Steve Clements, Director of American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. Now, Barack Obama has an interesting position in the Senate. He's chair of the European Subcommittee of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Explain its significance.
Well, and any committee in the United States Senate has very important subcommittees that deal with various topics. And when the Democrats came into the majority in the Senate, Barack Obama became chairman of the European subcommittee of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This same subcommittee was the one that Joseph Biden used to chair in the past. And I wrote a piece once where I was trying to look at the executive skills of legislators and comparing at the time Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. I had assumed that Hillary Clinton hadn't had much time for these and that Barack Obama, who was relatively new to the Senate, would have been drilling into some of the policy issues by chairing committees and hearing them. And I found somewhat the opposite. It wasn't an effort to try and undermine Obama, but I was astonished that he'd never chaired a policy hearing in the subcommittee. When I dug deeper, I talked to Senator Obama's advisors. They said, Steve, you realize we have to get permission from the chairman, meaning Joe Biden, to hold these committees. And I dug into it. Senator Biden would have been happy to provide any of that permission. So the important thing is this subcommittee could have talked about anything dealing with Europe or NATO's responsibilities. And most importantly, those responsibilities in the near term have been Afghanistan. And I think that it was just a part of Barack Obama's profile that he hadn't filled out yet. And I think he responded honestly. He said when he got his campaign going, he didn't have a lot of time and didn't do it. But I think it's very important. And I think the Obama team realizes it's important that when they have responsibilities of that sort, they need to run in a lot of parallel tracks, particularly given his Senate responsibilities and his government responsibilities to keep. You can't just focus on one area and then neglect a portion of your key responsibility as chair, which I think unfortunately was the case. But I think this has been a little bit overplayed in the press. I do think that he knows quite a bit about Europe, and I suspect that before the year's out, even before he runs, you'll find a subcommittee hearing this next season.
We're talking to Stephen Clements, Director of American Strategy Program at New America Foundation, runs the blog, thewashingtonnote.com. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, he'll be joined by Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist. He talks about Barack Obama's advisors, hawks behind the dove, who makes Obama's foreign policy, and also has a new piece on a database that could lead, he says, to a church-style investigation on the scale of Watergate. At least that's what he's calling for. Stay with us. Blaine and Stephen here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 700 stations, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 200 are, and they're also there in Spanish transcript form as well as in English. So go to that website, democracynow.org. As we continue on this historic moment yesterday, a presidential candidate from the United States, in this case Barack Obama, traveling Europe, standing in Berlin, hundreds of thousands of people came out to see him. Our guests are Stephen Clements, Director of American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, and we're also joined by Tim Shorrock, investigative journalist and author. His article, Hawks Behind the Dove, Who Makes Obama's Foreign Policy? Your thoughts on his European trip, Tim Shorrock, and who does, do you believe, influence Obama's policy? We're going to try to correct the audio there. Tim Shorrock's microphone just has to be turned on. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. But let me put that to Steve Clements. Steve, the advisors behind the man.
Has a diverse set of advisors, but in particularly Middle East policy and some European policy, he has some folks like Dennis Ross, Kurt Campbell, James Steinberg. We saw a lot of video with Jim Steinberg, a former deputy national security advisor in the Clinton administration, behind Barack Obama at various meetings, and others. But it's been, to some degree, Dennis Ross that has raised a lot of ire. I haven't read Tim Shorrock, his great friend, and I haven't read his piece, although about 100 people have emailed it to me overnight, and apparently it's a real sizzler. But the issue is that there is what Ari Berman of The Nation once wrote about some of the Democratic hawks as a strategic class of advisors who, in the way in which they approach these issues, feel as if they need to be very pro-military, very pro-Pentagon, design policies that almost look for a conflict or crisis by which to define their presidency and their campaign. And frankly, I'm very opposed to that sort of thinking because it creates an orientation that I think, this will be a bit provocative, but I think it creates an atmosphere of almost being a left or a left version of a neoconservatism, finding crisis to define themselves, and a militancy shrouded in values that I think really neither solves the problem we're trying to focus and really puts America and American interests in a very awkward and, I think, jeopardized position.
Let's see if we can go to Tim Schurach. Tim, in San Francisco, let's see if we've got that mic up. Tim?
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Why don't you go on with that issue of who are the advisors that are influencing Barack Obama's foreign policy?
Well, the piece I wrote in The Progressive took a look at a lot of the people that have been advising him in general on foreign policy, people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, people from the previous administration of Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter. I think Steve's right. I think that a lot of people from that are advising Barack Obama on foreign policy are rather militant in terms of American foreign policy and its projection. They seem to come, the closest people seem to be people who have worked with Bill Clinton that were sort of on the dovish side of the war in Iraq, who opposed the war in Iraq from the very beginning. Brzezinski, for example, has really condemned U.S. policy in Iraq and said it's a huge step backward and has been very outspoken on the war. What I'm a little bit concerned about is pressures coming from various Democrats on Barack Obama to appoint someone like Richard Holbrooke to be Secretary of State, sort of these old standouts in the Democratic Party. I covered U.S. policy, particularly in Asia, during the Cold War, and at a time when people like Richard Holbrooke and Brzezinski were running U.S. foreign policy for Jimmy Carter. And I have a lot of problems about the way that they dealt with issues such as the democracy movement in South Korea when, in the U.S. eyes, it became a perceived threat to American national security interests. And also, there's a very warlike tendency on the part of some of these Democrats to respond with force when perhaps we could be using negotiations in different places of the world. And I'm a little bit concerned about that, and I think that the direction of his foreign policy is very unclear. He says a lot of very good things, but exactly what he'll do, it's very hard to read.
You begin your piece by talking about Cuba's dramatic announcement last February that Fidel Castro was stepping down as head of the Cuban government, presenting Barack Obama with an unprecedented opportunity to establish his foreign policy credentials and set him apart from Hillary Clinton. What road did he choose?
Well, he pretty much stayed, actually, to the Clinton position and basically the Bush position. I think he had an opportunity here to explain to the American people and take a position that this embargo has simply not worked. I mean, Castro did step down voluntarily, but it certainly created a lot of animosity between the U.S. and the Cuban people. And, you know, if you compare Cuba to China, I mean, we have all this trade with China, openness in terms of business and investment, yet we continue to treat Cuba like a pariah state. And I think that was a mistake. And I think he could have come forward and said, you know, this embargo hasn't worked. He did make some mild comments at the beginning, sort of taking issue with, like, we need a new policy in Cuba. But he pretty much proceeded to lay out a response, and he gave a very he gave a speech in Miami to Cuban Americans that basically echoed the policy of the Bush administration and Hillary Clinton, which is to take a very hard line toward the Cuban leadership and not do anything drastic in terms of changing American policy until there's a new regime there. And I feel like, in a sense, that's a calling for a regime change in Cuba, rather than trying to work with the Cuban leadership on developing, you know, starting someplace and, you know, expanding trade and expanding, letting people visit there and creating a more normal atmosphere so there can be a change in policy both in the United States and Cuba.
Amy,
he didn't really take that chance.
Might I add
Steve
to
Clemens.
Tim's comment on this?
Yes, go ahead.
I think that Tim's point is extremely important. To give Barack Obama credit, at the end of July, when he spoke in Miami, he did call for an increase in the amount that Cuban American families could remit back to family and relatives in Cuba, and wanted to remove restrictions on Cuban Americans living here and traveling to Cuba. And those were two steps in a project. What was interesting about that speech, it was nonetheless wrapped as a major change among presidential candidates in U.S.-Cuba policy. I wrote a piece at the time that said Chris Dodd set the gold standard of wanting to remove all restrictions, end the embargo, and ending the embargo and promoting people-to-people exchange, particularly even if the embargo isn't lifted, would create new currents, new opportunities, and it would fit a lot of what we've done with Vietnam, China, other countries that, in fact, have been isolated by us. What was interesting is that Barack Obama was very pleased with the way in which we gave him some credit at the time. As time moved on, however, particularly after his bold statement about being willing to meet foreign leaders, which problematic foreign leaders, which I thought was a very important step and I think a defining element and ornament in Obama's campaign, I found it odd, and I raised it with Susan Rice, one of Barack Obama's foreign policy advisors, on a public media conference call. I asked, why wasn't Barack Obama willing to go back to the status quo that existed even under the George W. Bush administration between 2001 and 2004, which in particular provided for people-to-people, non-tourist cultural exchange and travel? And the response we received on that phone call was basically that when we saw free and fair elections and a change in the climate regarding human rights, et cetera, all sounds good, but it's pretty much where the Bush administration is, then we would consider other changes. And I found that to be remarkable that after five decades of a failed embargo, I'm less critical of Zbigniew Brzezinski than Tim. What I find interesting about Zbigniew Brzezinski on Cuba, for instance, is that Brzezinski is completely against this embargo, completely for engagement in various. I think the Brzezinski we see today is not the Brzezinski we saw as a Machiavellian realpolitik manipulator in the world. I think Brzezinski sees America has lost a moral credibility and edge in the world, and he wants to see some of that restored. But what's interesting, I was just talking to him the other day about Cuba. He thinks Barack Obama's position, he's advising him, falls short. And it falls short in the Middle East as well in some issues there. So I want to emphasize that Tim is absolutely right in some way. Obama stepped forward a little bit, but then he triangulated back and began to act a little bit less robustly committed to a change. And why is Cuba important? Cuba is important because it is a template. It's an easy way at very low cost to show the world that you're going to engage it differently. I tend to be more in the kind of progressive realist camp. I'm not the greatest fan of Hugo Chavez and Venezuela, like some of my friends may be. But nonetheless, it would enable us to show in Latin America and many other places in the world a very different kind of engagement over world problems. Cuba is the only place in the world where the Cold War got colder in the last decade. And to do that removes an ability for Hugo Chavez to declare bragging rights, if you will, about Cuba and to show it. I feel the same way about Syria and Iran. Let's open up to Syria a bit more. Let's move some people. Let's take Syria to some degree out of the cold. An automatic distance begins to develop between Syria and Iran that can be both, frankly, good for everyone and stabilizing. This is the kind of thinking I would like to see the Obama camp show more sensitivity towards, and it hasn't happened, just like Tim Shorrock said.
Well, Steve Clements, I want to thank you for joining us, and we'll see if that kind of discussion goes up, especially around the Olympics in China and the comparisons of how the U.S. deals with China and Cuba. Steve Clements is with the New America Foundation, runs the popular blog, thewashingtonnote.com. Tim Shorrock, I'd like you to stay with us to talk about your latest piece. On Capitol Hill, the House Judiciary Committee is set to hold a hearing today on Congressmember Dennis Kucinich's measure to impeach President Bush. Part of the hearings expected to examine the administration's surveillance, detention, interrogation, and rendition programs. The hearing comes as new details emerge about the Bush administration's domestic surveillance operations. Salon.com reports Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill are being urged to conduct a sweeping investigation into the White House's domestic surveillance program along the lines of the famous Church Committee investigations of the 70s. Salon has also published new details about a top secret government data database that might be at the heart of the Bush administration's domestic spying operations. The database is called Maine Core. It reportedly collects and stores vast amounts of personal and financial data about millions of Americans. A former intelligence officer told Salon.com the database was designed for use by the military in the event of a national catastrophe, a suspension of the Constitution, or the imposition of martial law. Some former U.S. officials believe Maine Corps may have been used by the National Security Agency to determine who to spy on in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Tim Shorrock wrote the piece in Salon.com. His latest book, by the way, is called Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. So, Tim, tell us about this database and its significance.
Well, from what I've been able to learn about it, it dates back to the Reagan administration. There's a program that's been in place since about 1983 called the Continuity of Government Program, and this was basically to preserve government functions in case of a nuclear war,
the COG.
Catastrophic attack, the COG. And it was actually run by, under the Reagan administration, by former president and former vice president George H.W. Bush. But this program was basically, to disperse people to different parts of the country when the government was attacked, when the country was attacked. And people that were involved in this program from the Bush administration include Vice President Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, and actually Cheney's chief of staff, David Addington, were all involved in sort of practice runs where they would suddenly get a call and be told to go to a certain place to practice this continuity of government exercise. And they did this through the 80s, a little bit in the 1990s. President Clinton apparently sort of de-emphasized this whole plan, but it came back, and a version of it was run during the 9/11 emergency when, we remembered Vice President Cheney always going to undisclosed locations, but many other officials and congresspeople went with him to various places to carry on the functions of government. Now, when this program was created during the Reagan administration, there was a database, some kind of watch list that they used that was developed to keep track of Americans that the government believed were threats to national security, subversives in some way. And there were different incidents where information about this database came out. For example, there were stories in both the Miami Herald and some newspapers in Texas, the Austin Herald American, that they reported about this database and how Oliver North, who was very involved in the Iran-Contra controversy when he was working at the White House, was actually might be using this database as a way to keep track of, say, Central American immigrants and people who opposed the U.S. policy in Central America during the 1980s. And at one point during the Iran-Contra hearings, Representative Jack Brooks of Texas focused on this and asked Oliver North about this database, which at that time was believed to be controlled by the Federal Emergency Management Administration, FEMA. And immediately, Senator Dan Inouye, who was the chairman of the Iran-Contra hearings, cut him off, said that deals with very sensitive classified information. We can't talk about it. And it was never really discussed. And there's been articles about it. And I began to learn a few months ago that this database, which some people now call Maine Corps, is still in existence and actually is being used by U.S. intelligence agencies as a way to keep track of Americans and also run names. Apparently, it holds all kinds of information around on millions of Americans. There was an article recently also in Radar magazine where they said 8 million names are in this database. And what I've been told is that the database still exists. Of course, it was still created for martial law circumstances and in a period of absolute crisis in the United States where there would be sort of military government in place in different parts of the country, an extreme measure, in other words. And what I've been told also is that this could have been the root of the dispute when, as people may remember, the Attorney General John Ashcroft and some of his deputies, when they reviewed the NSA surveillance eavesdropping program that was operating without warrants, decided that something was illegal about the program, and they had a confrontation in John Ashcroft's hospital room, and the dispute went on for some weeks until it was resolved by President Bush. But I've been told that it's very likely likely that that dispute focused on those databases, on this one database and its use by the NSA to look at specific Americans, and as a way to do the eavesdropping. Now, we don't know this for sure. I reported it in the context of there is this push to have some kind of investigation of the Bush administration's policies on intelligence, and that this is certainly be an area that should be looked at.
Can you explain more about INSLAW, about the past, and also comparisons with the possibility of a Church Commission, a Church Committee investigation?
Well, INSLAW is a company that produces computer software for the government, and it's been doing it for many years. It was started by a guy named Bill Hamilton, who was actually in the National Security Agency during the 1960s. He produced a software that's been used for years in the Justice Department to keep track of cases that are filed against, you know, anybody. It just could keep track of criminal cases as they're carried through the Justice Department. And apparently it has a very strong, you know, very good searching capabilities. It operates kind of like Google, but it was invented long before Google was ever around. It can search databases very quickly and come up with all kinds of information. And INSLAW has had a claim for many years that's been investigated by several committees in Congress, various courts, where he claims that this software was basically stolen by the Reagan administration Justice Department, misappropriated, and given to the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the CIA as a way for them to keep track of intelligence cases because of its very strong search capabilities. And he has a lot of evidence to show this, that it was investigated. He hired lawyers like Elliot Richardson, the former Secretary of Defense, to take his case to the CIA and various intelligence officials. In my story, actually, his software was called Promise, P-R-O-M-I-S. And in my story that was in Salon the other day, I did get a former National Security Council official who used to work very closely with the NSA on tracking financial transactions around the world say that, in fact, the NSA had used this software as a basis for its searching. So there is definitely some evidence that, you know, the software, which Hamilton and INSLAW claim is the basis of this main core database, you know, was used by U.S. intelligence agencies. Now, as far as the Church Committee idea, what I reported was that there's been meetings held primarily on the House side with House Democrats and their aides, various organizations that are concerned about civil liberties, like the ACLU, sort of saying, you know, look, we've had a very difficult time uncovering all of what's happened under Bush and Vice President Cheney in terms of, you know, policies on torture, interrogation, rendition, the whole surveillance program, the whole war on surveillance program. Maybe there should be another Church Committee, as was set up during the 1970s, to look at intelligence abuse. And I obtained a document, a memo that was written sort of as a think piece that was written by a former senior member of the Church Committee. And in this memo, he outlined how it would work. And one of the interesting things about the memo was the suggestion that any investigation like this would have to go back to earlier administrations. In other words, there's been a lot of terrible things and very questionable things have happened under Bush and Cheney, but we don't know the origins of these programs, and it'd be important to go back to look at how they actually began and go back to this Reagan administration continuity of government, for example, and see what the roots of any kind of, you know, database that might be used targeted at the American people. And the Church Committee itself, if people remember, actually went back to the days of Franklin Roosevelt. So it was started during the 70s under Nixon because of reports in the New York Times and other media by Seymour Hersh and reporters like him who exposed the CIA's domestic spying on Americans. And then the Church Committee got started in the Senate, chaired by Senator Frank Church There was an accompanying House committee as well, and they looked at all aspects of U.S. intelligence, and in particular, they looked at this whole use of watch lists by various agencies like the FBI and the CIA, and they exposed during the Church hearings. That's how the whole NSA spying came out, because they got the whole story about how the NSA had been listening in on the phone calls of many prominent anti-war activists, African-American organizations, civil rights leaders, and so on. And they exposed the various programs of the NSA, and that's how the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act emerged, was the Congress did not want to have the rights of Americans, the civil liberties abused by their intelligence services anymore, and so they passed FISA as a way to require warrants when there was any kind of monitoring of Americans in the United States by the NSA. And that was the guiding law until it was recently changed by Congress.
We're going to have
so
to
this
leave.
So need...
Timmy, 30 seconds.
Well, so there's this, you know, so people are saying, look, the Bush and Cheney have done a lot. They've stonewalled Congress. We've gotten a little bits and pieces here and there of this story, but we need the full story, and that's why there's a need for a committee. I'm not sure if the Democrats will support it, because a lot of them signed off on some of these programs.
Tim Sherrock, so I want to thank you for being with us, investigative journalist, author of piece at Salon.com on Main Core. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to Chicago, to the largest convention of journalists in this country. It's 10,000 journalists of color. Juan Gonzalez will be joining us with guests there. Stay with us. police every breath you take. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to Chicago, where nearly 10,000 journalists of color are gathered for a convention that brings together members of the National Association of Black Journalists, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the Asian American Journalists Association, and the Native American Journalists Association. It's organized by Unity. Unity began over 20 years ago in Philadelphia over a conversation between our very own Juan Gonzalez and Will Sutton of the National Association of Black Journalists. The first conference in 94 in Atlanta drew over 6,000 people, the largest gathering of journalists in U.S. history. We now host a discussion about race, politics, and the media. We're joined by two guests at the conference, Roberto Lovato, frequent commentator on immigration and Latino politics, writes for New American Media and blogs at ofamerica.wordpress.com, and Amy Alexander, the Alfred Nobler Journalism Fellow at the Nation Institute, writing a book about race and the media. Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez is there as well, past president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. This weekend, he's being inducted into the National Association of Hispanic Journalists Hall of Fame. It's a gala this evening in Chicago. First, Juan, congratulations.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, it's great to have you all with us. Juan, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, well, I'd like to start. Obviously, this conference, the Unity Conference, comes at a time when there is enormous upheaval in the old stream media, in newspapers, radio, and television, as they're confronting huge changes, downsizing, massive layoffs are occurring, and that's been the big topic of conversation at this convention. I'd like to ask, starting with Amy Alexander, your sense of, at this particular juncture, the changes in the industry and how it's going to affect the coverage of the growing population of people of color in the United States?
Well, the picture so far is not very encouraging. I mean, in this election year, we've already seen the sort of, the downside of a press corps that did not know how to cover Senator Obama or Senator Clinton, for that matter. You know, there were these narratives that would develop and then take hold. And, it became pretty obvious that not having more people of color on these really high-intensity, high-profile beats created perhaps, more turmoil in terms of the coverage and the stories that would take hold than, maybe wouldn't have been the case otherwise.
But ironically, during the primary campaign, at least, you saw for the first time on channels like CNN and even Fox and MSNBC more African American, Latino, and women commentators and analysts, supposedly, than you ever had before. But
sure.
At the level of the local media, which is where most people get their news, you've had very little change in the overall composition of the workforce.
Except a lot of those individuals were campaign operatives, the Democratic Party analysts and strategists, who get grabbed, many of them, because they're in Washington, frankly, and they move in the same circles as the assignment editors and this sort of thing. But the reporters on the beat of either the White House or with the major campaigns is not very diverse. That group is not at all diverse.
Roberto, in terms of the impact on, obviously, the big story in America today, the presidential campaign, I remarked at a breakfast on Unity yesterday morning that my fear is that if Barack Obama is elected president, then on January 21st, 2009, mm-hmm. You'll have this huge chorus of cries going by many people in white America. You see, racism is over. There's no more need for any kind of programs now because we've proven America is no longer racist. We've elected a black president.
Well, first of all, Juan, congratulations to you for your impact. A lot of us have benefited from yours and the efforts of others, and it's a great pleasure to see that you're being honored. As far as what I call the Obamaization of media in the United States, in other words, talking about having a lot of more colorful and colored people on the camera, but without talking about race directly, and talking about especially working class black, Latino, Asian, and other issues. That's my big fear right now with the consolidation of the industry, with the discourse of a post-racial society taking hold with an Obama candidacy. We do run the risk of some of the racist sentiments in the United States being codified and inserted into mainstream discourse even further than it is now. And so I think it's important for gatherings like Unity, NHJ, NABJ, all the different groups, they're more important than ever in many ways in terms of a reminder to ourselves and to the larger society that, you know, race is an issue in media and it affects the quality. I mean, you can have a lot of black, Latino, Asian faces, but we need to be concerned about issues more than just about culture necessarily. We need to be concerned about, you know, what's Obama's relationship to empire? But we're not asking those questions.
I think the other thing, too, that has come to the foreground more, at least in this convention, is the issue of the continued concentration of ownership in media companies and all of the professional organizations of journalists of color have taken stands now in recent years opposing increased media concentration. And NHJ, I think, is one of the few that's actually on record continuing to favor net neutrality in the internet in terms of where the major communications companies and the telecoms want to eliminate net neutrality. Your sense of how of the continuing battle over media concentration and the role in communities of color being able, because many of the civil rights organizations now are not signing or not opposing media concentration in the way that they should.
Well, I think that you touch on, I think, one of the issues of our time, but most of us don't even know what it's about. It's the equivalent of, say, controlling the railroads in the industrial age. What happens with the net, the access to the net? If corporations are allowed to control access to the internet, as is proposed, we run the risk of, you know, massive, even more massive distinctions between rich and poor. So you have organizations, major black, Latino, and Asian organizations, not really taking a position. And this is in part because of the major corporate funding that they're getting from Comcast and other major interests that are invested in controlling the internet. So we really, as individuals and as communities and voters, we need to speak loudly. And this is one where Obama's actually been good on.
Amy, you raised in a recent article the contrast between this convention of Unity Journalists of Color and again, has a lot of media company sponsorships, corporate sponsorships, and another conference that is occurring in Atlanta this week of bloggers, of people of color who are involved in the blogosphere.
Yeah, it's sort of uncanny, you know, that this small group in Atlanta is forming and having its first convention at the same time as Unity is having its quadrennial. The contrasts are pretty stark, but there are similarities.
And that conference is called?
It's called Blogging While Brown. Mm-hmm. And the organizers of Blogging While Brown described to me, you know, their reasons for forming this group, this association, and why they felt it was important to have a meeting in one place and one time, sharing of ideas, talking about strategies, training opportunities among bloggers of color. And those are the same reasons why black journalists and Latino journalists formed their respective organizations, you know, 30 and 40 years ago. So it just sort of was an indication to me of what you might say the ascent of the blogosphere, I think, that even though bloggers are, you know, it's a sort of nascent, it's very early yet in terms of whether or not what blogging sites as vehicles for providing news, as platforms for providing news, we don't really know how that's going to shake out in terms of their ability to provide comprehensive coverage. And yet already you're seeing that among this community of bloggers, many of them feel a need to form sort of these protective organizations.
Amy Juan Underberto,
I want to thank you very much for joining us. That brings us to the end of the broadcast. And Juan, I just want to say congratulations again. Again, Juan Gonzalez tonight being inducted into the National Association of Hispanic Journalists Hall of Fame at the meeting of the largest meeting of journalists in this country. It's Unity, and it's happening in Chicago. That does it for our show. Thank you to Amy Alexander and Roberto Lovato. Thanks to Mike Berkshire, Hildo Caduce, Anjali Kamat. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.